So this morning, I'd like to talk about the first of the six Gone Beyonds. So I gave five talks during this retreat we had of 5 days, which I think was 3 weeks ago, and I talked about the paramitas in those talks. And today, I want to talk a little more. And one of them I gave on a Sunday, actually, so some of you heard a little bit about them, and you probably studied them because they're important in Zen practice. So today I'm going to talk about the first one, dana. Dana, or giving, or generosity. So first of all, we have the six gone beyonds, the six paramitas, and they are, according to Bodhidharma, they're a boat. They're a boat that helps us leave this shore that we're stuck on, whether it be whatever we're stuck on. Whatever we use to dull our pain, whether it's work, or drugs, or alcohol, or porn, or more work. I know that one pretty well. What we do to dull our pain. So we leave the shore, we go beyond the shore, and we enter the sea of life where there's suffering. Where lots of stuff's happening. It's not just suffering, but there's suffering. We engage directly with it. And we have a boat. And the boat is the boat of the paramitas. And generosity is the frame of the boat. Dana, what I'm going to talk about today. Ethics is the keel of the boat. You want a steady keel so you don't do something that will hurt someone, right? You don't want to hurt someone. Patience is the hull. Effort is the mast. Meditation is the sail. And wisdom is the helm. To help us navigate through the sea of life and not be stuck on some dead habit or way of dulling out the pain that we feel as human beings. And when we enter the sea, we open ourselves to other people's pain too. But we need the boat or we'll drown in the sea. So that's why the boat is there. So, and since we're practicing, we're doing Zen Buddhist practice, we want a couple other boats to help us. We want a boat. It's good to, if you're sailing and you haven't had experience, it's good to have someone who's learned how to sail in a boat next to yours. Or maybe even on your boat. So we call that a teacher. In meditation, it's good to have a teacher, somebody who's learned to sail. Not perfectly, because you never know what kind of wind is going to come up. Even if you sail for 50 years, some wind will crash you into the shore sometime. But a fallible teacher, not an infallible teacher. Don't be very mistrustful of infallible teachers. And you need other people, too. Other people who are sailing with you. A community. A community only needs, can be just two or three people. I mean, luckily, we've got a lot of people. But you only need one other person to have a community to help you navigate the waters of travail. I mean, we all know about travail. Much more than we'd like to know about travail. We know. That's why we're always going back to the shore. Going back to our anxiety and our dulling ourselves out and our repeating the same things over and over again. So, dana, giving, generosity. Giving is traditionally of three types of giving. Material things, words, and giving as relinquishment. Material things, words, and giving as relinquishment. And people say to me, I can't afford to give. I hear that a lot. I can't afford to give. I'm not in the 1%. I'm in the bottom 1%. I can't afford to give. That 1% should be giving. What about me? But that's not our attitude. Our attitude is that anybody can give. Anybody can give some kind of material thing. So the mythological or semi-mythological figure who helped Buddha is Sujata. Sujata was the poor goatherd. And she came across this starving meditator. Why would a meditator starve himself? Well, that's a different question, isn't it? Starving meditator, name who was later called Shakyamuni Buddha. And she milked her goats, one of her goats, gave him milk. Now, she was from a very poor family. That milk was for her family. And she needed to bring that milk home to her family. But she saw this meditator who was very needy for some sustenance. And after she gave him that milk, then his whole affect changed, his whole countenance changed. And did she know that he would have a great awakening? Remember, this is probably a myth. No, she didn't know, she just gave. But when we give something to someone, if we give with our whole heart, we don't know. Very often they will be touched, even if it's something tiny. They'll be touched, it'll change their lives. Maybe only temporarily. I'm not a Marxist, but the one thing I've always liked about Karl Marx is his statement, from each according to his ability, to each according to his need. Right? That sounds like Shakyamuni Buddha or Jesus Christ, right? I guess Marx was well read. So then the second type of giving is the giving of words. Giving of words. So I'm going to read this little vignette from Jack Kornfield. Jack Kornfield's in the grocery store with his friend, who's a Buddhist practitioner like he is, woman friend. As we snaked along the aisles, we became aware of a mother with a small boy moving in the opposite direction and meeting us head on in each aisle. The woman barely noticed us because she was so furious at her little boy, who seemed intent on pulling items off the lower shelves. As the mother became more and more frustrated, she started to yell at the child, and several aisles later had progressed to shaking him by the arm. At this point, my friend spoke up. Braced for a confrontation, I felt a spike in my already elevated adrenaline. But instead, my friend said, "What a beautiful little boy. How old is he?" The woman answered cautiously, "He's 3. My friend went on to comment on how curious he seemed and how her own 3 children were just like him in the grocery store, pulling things off shelves, so interested in all the wonderful colors and packages. He seemed so bright and intelligent, my friend said. The woman had the boy in her arms by now, and a shy smile came upon her face. Gently brushing his hair out of his eyes, she said, "Yes, he is very smart and curious, but sometimes he wears me out." My friend responded sympathetically, "Yes, they can do that. They are so full of energy." As we walked away, I heard the mother speaking more kindly to the boy about getting home and cooking his dinner. "We're going to have your favorite, macaroni and cheese," she told him. So those were turning words. We have the term in Zen Buddhism, turning words, and we think it's about some big deal about having an enlightenment experience. But it's about life. It's about life. If we can just be with a situation, just with a situation, and just paying attention with our kind awareness, without criticizing, without judging, not giving advice, Unless advice is solicited. If it's solicited, that's cool. Then we can sometimes really, really transform a situation and a life, including our own life. So that's giving of words. Now the rest of the time I want to talk about the third kind of giving, which is giving as relinquishment. Since this is Zen. Or whatever that is. Yes, I guess that's right. Zen. So in our meal chants, we chant before we do our meal, may we with all beings realize the emptiness of the three wheels, giver, receiver, and the gift, right? We do that. So this invocation hopefully evokes giving and receiving without any thought of loss or gain. Very simple. Very simple. And this is a contrast to Buddhism, earlier Buddhism, even Mahayana Buddhism, and even later Mahayana Buddhism. And certainly Theravadan Buddhism, where giving is good because it accrues merit and creates karma that will bring future happiness. That's fine. Okay. It's true, but it's also can be very calculated. Very kind of, what am I going to get out of this? Where's the heart? Where's the spirit of giving when you're calculating? Oh, maybe I'll, because I do this, I'll get such and such. I'll get such and such. I'll get enlightened, or I'll be born in heaven, or people start being nice to me. I just keep giving more stuff to them, right? So I'll talk about the famous encounter between Bodhidharma and the Emperor Wu, which I actually used to talk about all the time here, and it is in my book that's just come out. So the famous, probably mythological encounter. More and more the scholars say that, well, supposedly the Emperor Wu of northern China visited Bodhidharma in his cave, where Bodhidharma had been sitting for just 9 years, you know, just taking a break for 9 years from worldly travails, right? But people don't believe that. Now there seems to believe that Bodhidharma and the Emperor Wu did have an encounter, but the Emperor would have never come to Bodhidharma's cave. A lot of hierarchy in China. A lot of hierarchy. Anyway, according to the myth, the Emperor Wu came to visit Bodhidharma. The Emperor Wu was an early convert to Buddhism. Buddhism is kind of young in China still. It's young. And an early convert to meditation. And so the Emperor Wu constructed meditation centers all around northern China. And he gave his, you know, put a lot of effort into it. And he'd heard about this very wise sage, Bodhidharma, who'd come from India and was the man who really understood meditation. So he went to visit Bodhidharma. And he said to Bodhidharma what a typical thing a Buddhist would have said at that time. Typical thing. First of all, he said, I've done all this. I did this temple and that temple and the other temple. Look what I did, you know. And how much merit have I earned? Very, very mainline Buddhist. How much merit have I earned? We think that's silly, but, you know, all religions do this. All religions do this. How much merit have I earned? Am I going to get... you know, is the grace of God going to be bestowed on me? How much merit did I earn? And of course, Bodhidharma says, no merit. No merit. And supposedly he growls it because if you see his countenance in any of the pictures, you wouldn't want to enter that zendo. You come see me instead. I'm so much nicer. Until you get to know me, at least. No merit. And then the emperor is taken aback. He's confused. He's made this huge journey with his retinue. And his retinue doesn't come to in the cave. They're not allowed. Only he's allowed. He doesn't even have them. He's by himself. And he says, well, then what's the first principle of your holy teaching? I guess I got it wrong. I thought I was doing this meditation to help all beings and then at least getting some good merit from that. At least getting some good merit. And so what does Bodhidharma say? A vast emptiness with nothing holy about it. A vast emptiness with nothing holy about it. And then the emperor is totally confused. And he says to Bodhidharma, thinks he's in the wrong cave. He's got the wrong guy. You know, there are lots of caves in China. Maybe he's in the Confucian cave instead. He didn't want to go to the Confucian cave. The Confucian cave is full of rules and regulations and what you do. And he thought he was going into the real Buddhist cave. So he says to Bodhidharma, who are you? And Bodhidharma says, I don't know. I don't know. So Bodhidharma has relinquished identifying with his small self. He's relinquished that. He's relinquished. And that's that relinquishment, that giving, is what comes out of this practice. So Bodhidharma is considered the founder of Zen. And I think the most important precursors to the founder of Zen were non-Buddhists or the Taoists, and I've talked about that. I've talked about this before quite a few times, Lao Tzu and Chuang Tzu. So if Bodhidharma is the founder and the Taoists are these original spark that caused Buddhism and Taoism to meet in China and create Zen, then I get to quote Chuang Tzu here, whom I always like to quote. So, what does Chuang Tzu say? Chuang Tzu lives at the time of Buddha and doesn't know anything about this paramita stuff, right? Or this, you know, great emptiness with nothing holy about it stuff. He's never heard this stuff. He's just doing his Taoist thing, right? So, Chuang Tzu says, if you can empty your own boat crossing the river of the world, no one will oppose you. No one will seek to harm you. Sounds like relinquishment, doesn't it? Sounds like relinquishment. We need the boat. We need the boat of ethics, ethical action, patience, effort, meditation. Ooh. That's just a reminder for us to be here and not go off. So we need that boat, but if we completely sail in the boat and take care of it, then the activity moves beyond the separation of the actor and the activity. A good sailor doesn't think I'm the sailor. Talk to my friend who's a master sailor. He doesn't, when he's in his races, and he does a lot of races, he's a person who comes to Zen Center here, he doesn't think I'm the sailor. He just does it. He just gives himself to it. Simple, right? So in a way, the boat is empty. It's empty. Okay, so here's a monk asking Wei Hai, Chinese Zen master Wei Hai, by what means can the gateway of our school be entered? Wei Hai said, by means of the Dana Paramita. The monk said, according to the Buddha, the Bodhisattva path comprises six paramitas. Why have you mentioned only this one? Please explain why this one alone provides a sufficient means for us to enter. Wei Hai said, deluded people fail to understand that the other five all proceed from Dana Paramita, and that by its practice all the others are fulfilled. The monk asked, why is it called the Dana Paramita? Weihai said, Dana means relinquishment. The monk asked, relinquishment of what? Weihai said, relinquishment of dualistic ideas. So our ideas get in the way of real openness, real relinquishment. So in our meditation, it's hard for us to relinquish, too. It's hard for us to relinquish. Suzuki Roshi's advice about meditation, which I like to quote whenever I see people struggling too much with their meditation, is, if you want to tame a horse, what? Give it a large pasture. If you want to tame a horse, give it a large pasture. No control. No control. Help. I need a control. I need to be really working at this meditation. I'm not wasting my time. Giving. Relinquishing. Not trying to deepen your sitting. You try to deepen your sitting. What happens? What happens when you try to deepen your sitting? Thoughts come in. I'm not doing it good enough. I should try this other technique. Maybe Tim really will give me the right technique this time. Or maybe I should go to Ben or Bouchot.
Not recommended.
So, remember it's the nature of the mind to wander. Remember. Remember that in this great field of being, this great ocean of being, there's no such thing as distraction. Well, I'm distracted. I should come back. But if you're just in the boat, taking care of, trying to be aware, trying to sail, you don't have to judge. You don't have to judge. And you have great generosity when you do that. Then you don't feel, I failed at my meditation. You never fail. That's you who's trying to get somewhere. In the boat, with your patience, with your ethical behavior, you're safe. You're safe. Especially if you have those other boats by you to remind you, to give you support. Because the ocean gets rough sometimes. And you want to run back to shore. And your boat's already too far out. Well, maybe you brought a TV on your boat, a portable TV. Or maybe you got your iPhone on the boat. I'm going to tell you, in this boat, iPhones are not allowed. Sorry. Well, if they help you with your patience, they're allowed. If they help you with your meditation, they're allowed. If they help you with your being ethical, they're allowed. So we can be so generous. We can be so generous that we trust our mind to settle down on its own. As the Buddha is supposed to have said, the way a bird trusts the tree, it builds its nest in. This is our tree. We're building our nest of bare awareness, of openness, open-heartedness in this tree. Can we just trust this tree? It's not the perfect tree. I resist calling the paramita the perfections. I totally resist it, even the virtues. And you get caught. They're the gone beyonds. They're the gone beyonds. But that's just my bias. You may have a different bias. We all have biases. When we notice our biases, we just give ourselves a belly chuckle and empty the boat. Right? Empty the boat. The boat's self-emptying. But there has to be the awareness. So Dante's Inferno. Dante says, abandon all hope, you who enter here. So why do we want to control? Because we want a different experience from this one. We hope for a different experience from this one. The Tibetan teacher Drukpa Khunlek asked, Are you afraid of being caught in the hell realms? And the student says, yes, that's why I came to see you. Duh. Do you hope to attain enlightenment? Yes, that's why I want to practice. Duh. Excuse me, I added the duh. It's not in the original text. Yes, that's why I want to practice. Khunlek said, go away with so much hope and fear. You can't possibly practice. I would be wasting my time giving you any more instruction. Just relinquish. Just relinquish. So as we sit in our meditation, in our attempt to just be with this boat, with this sail. The sail is the sail, remember, is meditation. Just with the sail. In our bare awareness, paying attention to the wind, the way the wind's blowing, and just letting the sail modify itself according to the wind. Just letting it modify itself according to the wind. We begin to relinquish. We begin to relinquish. And that relinquishment, as it happens, can evolve. It does evolve. It evolves into spaciousness. Spaciousness. A great emptiness, a great spaciousness, with nothing holy about it. Nothing holy. Nothing holy. And the Tibetan Buddhists call this restful spaciousness panoramic awareness. So our bare awareness opens up into panoramic awareness. On its own. On its own. It just opens up. In its own time. Its own time. So, when I was a boy, my first few years, this makes a good story. If you look at your life, there are all kinds of good stories from your life. All kinds of good stories. Where do we think all this Dharma came from? Where do we think these thousand books came from? They came from people's experiences in their lives. So, I grew up, not huge, but till I was, I don't know, 5 or 6, on Panoramic Way. Okay. In Berkeley, California. And Panoramic Way was very high. And we lived at the end of the road. But pretty cool. Pretty cool. I mean, so I grew up on, my first few years were Panoramic Way. But I didn't know much about it. I could barely even say the word, if I remember it. No, actually, I could say the word. I could say the word. So, one morning, when I was however old I was never allowed to sneak out of the house and look at the view, because I was too young. Although I was allowed. Things were different then. I was allowed in kindergarten to walk to school by myself. Does any of you remember that? We're old, like me. In kindergarten, we walked to school by ourselves. Now we have to, even in the third grade, we have to have a phalanx of parents and guards to get to school. Things have changed. Huh? Things have changed. So, my parents said, no, you can't do that. It's too dangerous to go look at the view. But then one morning, I snuck out. I mean, parents should know that if you give a directory to a 5-year-old boy who's already, you know, not into disobeying as his practice. Well, my earliest practice was disobeying. I haven't gotten over it exactly. That I would disobey. So one morning, my parents must have been sleeping in, probably a weekend, I snuck out before they were all asleep. My sister was asleep. And I went and down to where the view was. And I had never seen it before because I hadn't been allowed. And so I ran down there and I looked and I was just amazed. I was just amazed. little Tim, totally absorbed, totally gone in the brown of the hills, in the red of the Indian paintbrush that were all over the hills, in the blue of the sky, and in the ocean around, way out there, the ocean, going on forever, going on forever. And I didn't want to go back. I didn't want to go back, but I knew I better. So I got back before my parents woke up. So then when I was an adolescent, well, we moved away from that house and lived down where I grew up in Palo Alto, but when I had a very difficult adolescence. And so in adolescence, as soon as I got my driver's license, and my father let me use his car. He had a red and white Buick. You know, I don't remember much except these early things, right? He would let me take his red and white Buick, and I would go up to Panoramic Way to try to recover, to look at the view and try to get some stillness and all this angst I was feeling, this adolescent angst, which is not just adolescent angst, it's human angst. It's human angst. It's just that adolescents wear it more on their sleeves. We suppress it as adults. We're good about suppressing it with our work and our booze and our television. But it's angst. Oh. And I'd go up there, but it didn't work. It didn't work. I probably went up there 3 or 4 times. Meaning that I couldn't let go. It wasn't letting go of I. And the more I try to let go, the more I can't let go. Right? So after about 3 times, I didn't do it anymore. And then I got into drinking instead. I'm not going to talk about that today. So I wasn't able to relinquish. So it takes practice. Practice. Practice in this boat with a sail to learn to relinquish. And a good frame, the frame of giving, the frame of the possibility that at any moment we can just give ourselves to this, whatever it is, whatever it is. So there was not much religion in my family except for my grandmother and my Irish grandmother, who was a Catholic. When I talked to her, I do still talk to her. She's been dead for a long time, but I've talked about her. It's good to talk to dead people, you know. It's cool. It helps. In the big horse pasture, there's plenty of room to talk to people who are dead. They're not dead if they're still in our hearts. They're not dead. How could they be dead? Anyway, my grandmother, my Irish Catholic grandmother, who was my ally when I got into Zen practice. She tried to be generous her whole life. But she got tangled up. When you try to be generous, often you get tangled up. She got tangled up in, you know, was she doing it the right way? Did people appreciate her generosity? Did she do it well enough? She was under that shadow of this Irish Catholicism in my family, where you're always a sinner. Doesn't matter how generous you are, you're always a sinner. So my grandmother, we brought my grandmother from San Francisco to northern Minnesota when she was 84. We never should have done that. That was a weird thing to do. Weird thing. It's like taking. Well, you understand why that's weird, don't you? It's weird enough for someone from California who's young to come to Minnesota. Although I love it. I love it. So I was not present when my grandmother died, but my Aunt Alma was there. She died on the north shore of Lake Superior in a hospital. I don't even remember. Was it Two Harbors Hospital or the Duluth Hospital? It wasn't present, but my aunt said to me when my grandma died, she said, just before she died, "It's wonderful, dear. There's nothing to hold on to. I don't have to help anyone." Finally, she doesn't have to help anyone. Finally, she doesn't have help anymore. "It's wonderful, dear. All the judging is gone. All the judging is gone." So, we can imagine that we're about to expire. We may be about to expire. We inspire and then expire. We inspire and then we expire. See what happens then. How generous can you be to your breath as you expire? To your breath as you expire. My grandmother practiced the paramitas. She didn't know what she was, but good Catholics practice the paramitas. They don't call them the paramitas. She practiced charity big time, her whole life, big time. She practiced ethical, moral behavior big time. She really worked at it. She practiced patience. She said, "I'm not good at it, dear, but I practice it." I'm not good at it either. We're not good at this stuff. We practice it. That's all. But what she didn't have is she didn't have a sale for her book. She didn't have a sale for her book. She didn't have a meditation practice, and she didn't know about meditation practice. In those days, the Catholics, at least the Irish Catholics, but probably all the Catholics, they didn't know about centering prayer. They didn't know about centering prayer. So she was interested in my zazen, and that's a whole different story, because she thought, but it was really kind of late in her life. She didn't know. I mean, Thomas Keating did a wonderful thing. What he started in the early 70s, he did a wonderful thing. He brought back to life the meditation of the Benedictines, the centering prayer of the Benedictines, which is a great sale for your boat. It's just as good as zazen. It's not any different from zazen. It's a wonderful sale. But my grandmother didn't have that. And also, she didn't have someone who knew how to sail a boat. She had priests, but they couldn't help her sail that boat. They were too caught up by their doctrine, too caught up by trying to be good, and they couldn't. And she didn't have anybody else to do this with, because people didn't do that. Catholics didn't do stuff like that in those days, unless they became priests. But even the priests didn't seem to do it. At least that's what my grandma said. So now a second quote by our Taoist founder. I'm making him our founder. Chuang Tzu. Second quote on emptying or relinquishing. "You can't discuss the ocean with a wealth frog. He's limited to the space he lives in. You can't discuss ice with a summer insect. He's bound to a single season. You can't discuss the Tao with a cramped scholar. He's shackled to his doctrines. Now you have come out beyond your banks and borders that have seen the great sea, so you realize your own pettiness. From now on, it will be possible to talk to you about the great principle." So each time we get a petty entanglement, we get tangled up in something, it's showing us we're back on the shore. And we can always set sail again. The boat's there. We can just get in it. It's reminding us that we can set sail again. So, when I was with my daughter a while ago, she got mad at me, which does not happen very long. And I saw that she'd missed my point of view. She had misunderstood my point of view. So I explained my point of view to her. Then she got mad at me again. Even more mad at me. And finally, I apologized. So I was being a wealth frog. But at any moment, I could relinquish. Now, I didn't relinquish that first time. I felt I had to explain it to her. "Well, you missed the da-da-da-da," what I was saying. But I was being a wealth frog. And I was caught in my own little space. Oh, she's got to understand, you know. She wasn't asking for understanding. She was asking for empathy. She was asking for acknowledgement. She wasn't even asking for an apology. But I ended up having to give an apology because I kept, you know, I did this and I did it again and did it again. Ever had that experience? Anybody? Well, frog experience? So as your experience of meditation, of bare awareness, stabilizes, more and more you feel yourself that you're able to rest in the sea, regardless of whether it's calm. Rest in the sea, in your boat. Don't get out of your boat. Your boat helps you, and that's where you experience this emptiness. So here's Dogen. I'm going to end up with Dogen. You're always supposed to end up with Dogen. So it always ends. And see, now I'm starting to obey, finally, authority that I always hated. Well, you know why I'm obeying it? Because I am the authority. It makes it easier to obey. When you're, right? So Dogen. Last night, this mountain monk unintentionally stepped on a dried turd, and it jumped up and covered heaven and earth. This mountain monk unintentionally stepped on it again, and it introduced itself saying, "My name is Shakyamuni Buddha." So when I upset my daughter, I stepped on one turd. Then when I tried to explain myself, I stepped on another turd. But it was Shakyamuni Buddha. I saw the second turd finally. I could have taken me 10 turds to see it. Sometimes it does, or you don't see it at all. And that was Shakyamuni Buddha, that second turd. So I opened up to my daughter. I apologized. Didn't try to justify myself. Wow. Wow. It's pretty simple, isn't it? It's pretty simple. We get so tangled up, and it's pretty simple, this giving, this relinquishing. So my daughter was a spiritual friend in disguise. So whatever happens to us, that's a door to us living wakefully in the Buddha nature sea. That Buddha nature sea. So let's enjoy sailing together on the sea, okay? Sometimes it's rough. You can't sail by yourself. Get a partner. Sail with someone else. Have a me or some other person help you sail. But I'd also have a partner who's a beginner to do it with you. And we can enjoy sailing together. So then, I'm going to end with Dogen, because why not? Why not? When one learns giving well, being born and dying are both giving. All productive labor is fundamentally giving, and trusting flowers to the wind, birds to the season, also are meritorious acts of giving. So I think that's what I want to say for today, and I'll be glad to entertain questions or comments. Yeah.
Well, I was wondering, if it's okay, maybe get out of the boat if the water's nice, and then just have a swim.
Sure, why not? Sure, why not? Get out on the boat. Get out of the boat when the weather's nice, but you need to keep the boat in sight, because you never know when, you know, when the waves are going to start getting kind of rough. Yeah, get out of the boat. Don't be shackled to the boat. If you get shackled to the boat, then you're like the frog in the little tiny area who thinks, "Oh, this boat, this is the only way. I got to stick with this boat. I got to preach the one true way, which is living within this boat." Well, this boat is meant to help us empty, help us open. So one way to open is take a swim sometimes, right? Take a swim. You can swim far out without a boat as long as you're paying attention to the weather. Far out. Far out. Larry.
What if the boat hits an iceberg?
Well, the boat could always hit an iceberg. It could. It could. But you've got your three boats in my little vision here. So you're paying attention. You're paying attention with the three boats. You know? I almost, yeah. So I almost hit an iceberg in my relationship. I did hit with my daughter. But I just then, because I love my daughter, by the third time I really paid attention. So the iceberg melted before I, got in the way. Other folks? Okay, well, we'll turn it over to Boucher then.